The astronomers are basically light engineers. Ultraviolet radiation has the energy to ionize the matter. The first extragalactic black hole was detected in the ultraviolet with the IUE. The problem is not the nanosatellites because they are very small. Innovation is to do something new.
Welcome to the Eurospace Hub special episode from the podcast Business of Collaboration. Eurospace Hub aims to digitally connect the space ecosystem in Europe, from tech transfer offices to industry, space accelerator networks, research centers, and other universities. Eurospace Hub will allow these actors to easily connect with financial opportunities, from the Horizon Europe framework to space research, space technology, and to accelerator programs. Eurospace Hub will bridge the gap between academic institutions and industry using a collaborative ecosystem and entrepreneurial mindset inside the universities and beyond. Every month, with the Eurospace Hub special episodes, we want to share stories about space technology and research with you. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, Professor Ana Inés Gómez de Castro, to the podcast Business of Collaboration with a special edition for Eurospace.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Jara, for taking care of all of this.
Professor Gómez de Castro, you are full professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University Complutense de Madrid in Spain. As well, you are the founder of the Joint Center for Ultraviolet Astronomy at the university. What is the story behind all of this? How do you become full professor and found the center?
Okay. I joined the Complutense University, but coming from ESA, from the European Space Agency. So very close to the Complutense premises was the satellite tracking station, which was called VISPA, Villafranca Space, and the seat of the current European Space Astronomy Center. And in that center, that was created to work as the ground observatory of a space observatory. And the name of the observatory was International Ultraviolet Explorer, which was a joint mission from NASA, the British Space Agency, and NASA. So the observatory was operated in real time. It was one of the first observatories, so it was strange for the community to work on a space. So I guess that they tried to make something that looked like what was ground-based observations, that in ground-based observations, you go to the observatory, you have a week, they basically gave you the keys, and the observatory is yours to do your science, no? So they tried to do something intermediate. And that was a very, very nice environment. It was beautiful. And that's where I started in science. So it was a very, very nice environment. I did my standard academic career. I ended my PhD. Then I went as a postdoc to Canada. But I kept in the space business. And then when I returned to Spain, still I was working on the European Space Astronomy Center, well, in VISPA, at that time it was VISPA. And when I joined the staff of Universidad Complutense, I wanted to promote space astronomy and space science in general. So we were working hard on that sense. And at a certain time, from the ESA environment, really from this International Ultraviolet Explorer Observatory, there was the seed to create a World Space Observatory Ultraviolet. And the person who promoted was the director of the observatory, Willem Wonstecker, a Dutch astronomer. And we were working closely together to make that a reality. And then, well, we started working, me in the university, and he was working at the observatory. And at a certain time, we have to set the actual observatory, and we set it here in the university because ESA decided not to join in this adventure. So we had to run the project through bilateral programs. And then, it was decided to set it up here in the university. So I started setting a center for ultraviolet astronomy in the university. That's how the whole story started. And now it's joined because there are many people working on UV astronomy with us. We manage the network for ultraviolet astronomy, which has about 500 astronomers all over the planet. We are involved in several UV missions, and these are the premises of the World Space Observatory Ultraviolet, which should be launched in 3 years or more. We are waiting with the future of the relations between Russia, Roscosmos, and Europe, because the project is led by the Roscosmos Space Agency. But the center itself has contained, in terms of laboratories, operation center, databases, which makes it a preference, even as a standalone, even without a WSO.
I am thinking now with some audience, like maybe they don't know what we are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And you are a professor, so you are teaching as well at university. What is exactly ultraviolet astronomy and which type of results or benefits you have with these observations and some kind of examples of the projects you have in the center?
Okay. The astronomers are basically light engineers. We are specialized in understanding the information that is carried by light. This is very logical because we are studying the universe. We are studying things that are very far, far away. And the only thing that we receive from them is basically light. So this is our specialty. And we used to classify light radiation in different manners. Some are by the technique we use to analyze the radiation, and others relate with the wavelength or the energy of the radiation. So there is radio astronomy, and there is infrared astronomy, and there is optical astronomy, and there is UV astronomy, X-ray astronomy, gamma ray astronomy. Each one dealing with a specific wavelength or energy range. So what is special about ultraviolet astronomy? Well, because ultraviolet radiation has the energy to ionize the matter that we know. So it's very sensitive to study the atmospheres of the stars, to study the winds, to study the atmospheres of exoplanets, for instance, or to detect the star formation and analyze star formation. So in fact, the first observatories in space were ultraviolet. The first lunar observatory was in a small ultraviolet telescope, the Carruthers telescope, set by NASA. That was the purpose. That's the reason why it's so important. So we can go to very specific aspects that, for instance, the first extragalactic black hole was detected in the ultraviolet with the IUE. The stellar winds from massive stars were studied with IUE, this International Ultraviolet Explorer. If you go to other areas, for instance, the planetary aurora, the atmosphere of Jupiter or the Jovian planets, the thin atmosphere of Mars, there is no space mission, exploration mission, that is not carrying a UV instrument to study the diffuse atmosphere. And the same happens also, ultraviolet is very sensitive to hot matter in space, hot stars, massive stars. These are the ones that evolve the fastest. And as a result, they control the evolution of the universe. Because in the Big Bang, only very light elements were formed, like hydrogen, helium, beta-helium, beryllium. And most of the elements that are used for life were generated afterwards, were generated in the nuclear reactions that occur in the interior of the massive stars mainly. Okay? So massive stars were fundamental in the chemical evolution of the universe. And the massive stars radiate mainly in the ultraviolet. So these are some of the reasons why we work in the ultraviolet. From the technical point of view, ultraviolet means a wavelength range that is roughly between 3,500 angstroms and 1,000 angstroms, roughly. And all this range is not accessible, most of the range, basically from 2,800 angstroms, 1,000 angstroms. This cannot be observed from the ground because the ozone layer prevents this ultraviolet radiation to penetrate the Earth, so can only be studied from space. That's why ultraviolet astronomy cannot be carried without access to space.
Now you are talking about this, I remember, like, you are part of the International Astrophysics and Astronomy Associations, and you are very active there as well to protect the sky. Mm-hmm. We can say the dark and the quiet sky. And you saw me as well a presentation you have about the impact of the satellites and most nanosatellites we have now overcrowded our sky. And all the lines, you know, like you have in your pictures. So how is the impact of these nanosatellites in your ultraviolet observations?
Okay, the problem is not the nanosatellites because they are very small. The problem is the large constellations of satellites. In fact, the images you are talking about, the ones that I show you, correspond to the launch of satellites for the Starlink constellation. Okay? So that's a different story. And the problem is growing, and it does not affect only ground-based observatories. It also affects space-based observatories, which are in low Earth orbit, okay, to the point that the Hubble Space Telescope, there is a recent study published in Nature Astronomy, and I think that they were quoting about 10% of the data acquired by the Hubble Space Telescope that are affected in some manner by these big constellations. So what is the situation? The situation is, well, that professional astronomy is having troubles. And then what is being done are some strategies to palliate the problem with the assistance of the International Astronomical Union and basically and the COSPAR. And basically the idea is to create a center and some conferences where both industry and scientists meet and discuss to exchange information. Result of these conferences have been, for instance, that in the satellites, these big networks of satellites are now constellations of satellites. They are now made in a manner that they scatter, reflect less light to the Earth. So to prevent that, making that their images is not so bright in the astronomical data. But even though, I mean, this is a problem that ought to grow, and it has not a good solution because you cannot stop the future. You cannot put doors to the sea, as we see in Spanish. Okay? So it's something that is impossible, but it is going to change many things. And that's, in my opinion, that's one of the reasons why the moon is so important, because the moon is nearby, and the moon can be an excellent site for astronomy for the future.
You are listening to a Eurospace Hub special episode from the podcast Business of Collaboration.
I remember you were mentioning the part of creating satellite constellations and telescopes around the moon and how this is possible and the projects now from the Space Agency as a strategy to the future to work on this, no? But still, well, I am not a physical astrophysics or astronomer. My question to you is how much difficult is to launch from here to go to the moon to set up this type of telescopes and constellations? when it still is super, we can say, complicated to land into the moon. Is this required, or you can do it, only put it on orbit from the Earth to the moon?
No. I mean, there are many things that you can do. And they are being studied, and many of them are well analyzed already, which is the best position for an astronomical observatory in the near-Earth space. Well, it's going to the Lagrange point 2, which is a stable point in the around the Earth. And that is where all the major observatories are being launched. So ExoNewton, James Webb, the new missions, all they are going there. And that's the best place. Okay? Now, orbiting the moon has some problems, and landing on the moon has another. If you keep a satellite in lunar orbit, the satellite will go very fast. The orbit will be very fast. Okay? But now we have the technology to read fast and operate fast. So it's a challenge, but not that hard challenge. The only point is the cost, because launching something in low Earth orbit is about a tenth of the price of putting something on lunar orbit. Okay? So why would you go for the moon? Well, first you need someone who trusts your idea to convince that person or that entity, and then you can do it. Okay, and that has disadvantages, because you will not be affected by all the big constellations that are set around the Earth. And this is, I think, an unstoppable process related with services for all kinds of things and communications at global scale, because we are moving into globalization, clearly. And globalization means complete connectivity all over the globe. And this, you can only do it properly at a reasonable amount of money from space. So I don't think that this is going to stop. But all these services are for the big community, that are the people living in the Earth. Oh, 8,000 million people around. Oh, while on the moon, I think that in the next future, there will be at most 3-5 people, like in the Antarctica bases. So it's a completely different concept. Now, if you have people and you set a laboratory on the moon, having an observatory is a great idea, because you have dark skies. This is very relevant also for radio astronomers, because the noise at radio wavelengths is increasing, and they are having very important problems with that, no? So you can be on the dark side of the moon, so you will not be affected by the Earth radiation, and you can do experiments that are not that will not be able from the Earth or from orbit around the Earth. So the point is that setting something on the moon is more expensive, significantly more expensive than setting something in the L2, in this Lagrange point. But humans need to leave the Earth and to establish themselves in other bodies in the solar system. That's a requirement for humankind. We cannot be all the humans in a single planet. We have to move around, to extend. Okay? And if we do that, we have to start by the moon. And with that perception mind, setting observatories in the moon is the next step too.
And as well to get better qualitative data as well.
Yeah.
From the observations, no? Like you mentioned, you can have the next level of observations and maybe the next challenge, but as well new ideas and new reach.
Wonderful of the moon is that it has no atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, for instance, the astronomy, the Earth, is specialized on the windows that the atmosphere, the Earth atmosphere, is transparent to. Okay? So why radio? Because in radio wavelengths, there is a window where the radiation can reach us from space. Why infrared? In infrared, there are several bands where the atmosphere is transparent to radiation. Why optical range? Well, because it's where the atmosphere is transparent to the solar radiation. But it is not transparent for UV, X-rays, gamma rays. So you have artificial frontiers. And going to the moon, there will be not frontiers. And the people will be working naturally in X-rays, ultraviolet, or radio wavelength at the same time. So that's a very nice thing to do. Could be the World Lunar Observatory.
We have in this podcast the objective to disseminate everything we are doing in Eurospace Hub, but as well to disseminate the science and entrepreneurship and transfer of technology of space and aviation technologies and science. From the Complutense University, what is your role, and as well from your department, at Eurospace Hub?
Okay, so our role is to promote this transfer. And this is not easy at all. This is a real challenge. That's because you are a very courageous person, Hara, and you put us all together working in this project. But it is something that is very difficult. Okay? And because academia in Europe is not thought as a place to start up small industries, it's not thought like that. It is very much in the general administration structure. And most of the professors, myself, we are civil servants. So it's a concept that is very different from that of an entrepreneur. No? And that's, I think, is a major problem. So which is the role of the Complutense? Complutense is one of the largest universities in Europe. I think that only Rome is larger than Complutense. We are always fighting for this first stupid position because it's not a good position to be the first in number of students because it's not an efficient university, okay? But anyway, we are a very, very big university. And that has one thing that is very positive, and is that we have many grades. We have many students, but we have many grades. So in that sense, our university is very rich in knowledge. When you talk about space, you are not talking about a specific knowledge. You are talking about a line of development where all knowledge is required. You need lawyers, and you need economists, and you need chemists, and you need mathematicians. Usually you need engineers. You need many people of different profiles. Being a very large university, you have this enormous advantage of getting all the grades together. And that's something that we have been doing for Eurospace Hub. Okay, so we are in the nodes in the Complutense is made up of two research groups, one in international and space law, another related with space astronomy, which is our group. And what we have been doing is training in space law, training on how to set up a company, which is not trivial, how to set up a company for space, how to transform your idea into a practical business. Well, I think that it's been a challenge, but we are enjoying it, in fact.
Yeah, that's the part, because I remember I was, I think, March last year, 2023, in Madrid, participating in one of your classes, but you did another one in October. So, and they were complementary, both, which is super interesting, and both super mega interesting. So can you explain these two different educational programs you have created? Because students and as well professionals were allowed to participate. And as well, you had a very nice mix of experts coming to teach. So it was not only professors from Complutense, like as well, but as well, they were industry experts. So can you explain how you elaborate this educational program for space entrepreneurship and innovation?
Okay, there were two programs. In fact, we organized four programs. Okay, the first one, the one that you are talking about, the one in March, this was devoted to how to set up a space company. It was oriented to a space law. So we use the people that we know that were part of our team, people also from Spain, space Aerospace Law Association, which is also based in Madrid, and also some people we know from the industry, because, I mean, our center is involved in collaboration with many companies, so we have very close connection with the industry network around. So the first course was organized in that sense. That's how we searched for the professors. Now, the second course was oriented to another completely different issue. It was a space law, but it was data rights. And that was a course that was honestly prepared by the team, which is in the law school. And they have been working in this for many years. There is a lot of discussion internationally about the data rights of satellite images, which is a very important issue, by the way. That's how it was generated and set. Then the other two courses that we organized, one was not set in the Complutense University, but we moved into Scientific Science and Outreach Center, which is like 100 kilometers from Madrid. And there we met teachers, high school teachers, and we were working with them to design a CubeSat. And we have set up with them a reception antenna for CubeSats, so they can use data from satellites, actually. And it was very, very interesting. We gave them a sort of primer on what was a CubeSat, which was the format of the data, and the teachers, touching technology, computer science, they were very eager to work with us, and this is work in progress. We are doing that with them. And the other course that was in November, that's the one that you came after. I mean, we had a meeting while we had that course. It was to show this multidisciplinary aspect of a space exploration. And that what we did is to search for everybody who really is working on a space project in the campus. And we joined them on to teach our students. And it was a great success because we joined them with the people from the industry. Our team is also part of the Plataforma Aeroespacial Española, the Spanish aerospace platform. So they came over. We have many industries collaborating with us. And the best thing of all is that for 3 weeks, all afternoons, from 4 p.m. till 8 p.m., we had more than 70 students attending all the classes, which is amazing. So it was, and the feedback we have received for them is fantastic, and they have many more students that are willing to come. In fact, they are asking us whether we organize again the next year.
If you want to be part of the European space innovation ecosystem in a digital format, go to our website to read more information about how to join. www.eurospacehub.com.
It's a result, or we have this impact because we saw a missing piece was there, like we have to fill out. And now we have the proof, like this is, it was something was missing.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But I think you are preparing something for this year, no? For February, March, if I don't mistake.
Yeah, we are preparing something together with the International Space University.
So in Madrid? No.
It's in Madrid, but I don't know whether physically or remotely. Okay, I don't know how we will do it at the end. But you have to think about our consortium. Okay, so what is our consortium? Our consortium is made of people with very special capacities, no, and institutions. So we have the International Space University, which is a reference in Europe for master degrees in space. And not only in space technology, but on space business, on starting a company, etc. So they are at that level, master level, and they are also at the level of a transfer to society, starting a business. Okay? And then is we, the Complutense. And Complutense is a very large university in Europe with many different degrees that have applications for space exploration. And what we have is the capability to exploit this multidisciplinary aspect and join together and enrich the concept. And then, and we have business school too, and law school, and many more things. And then we have the Vilma and Vilnius University, with a very powerful transfer office, a very active, amazingly active transfer office, which put the third step. So we have graduate school, undergraduate school, transfer office, and then we have obviously Leiden in many different manners, because we have it through the Lunes Foundation, but through many other issues, which is a reference, it's a European reference, it's the European reference in space science and technology. And then, well, we have you, and we have our Ukraine colleagues, and all together we have all this set of expertise. So the course that we are going to have in March is a course which is more related with entrepreneurship, but not from the legal point of view, but from the business organization point of view, no? And that's why ISU is preparing the key program and will be distributed among the, everybody, all the attendees.
Yeah, you explained it very well. And this is the part of, I think, very complementary consortium, like pieces of a puzzle, like everyone is bringing their own expertise and perspective.
Exactly.
And I think one of the next challenge maybe we have is how we can make all of this accessible for everyone who is interested in space, innovation, entrepreneurship, which is the next challenge. Because on one hand is how to empower other universities to have this curriculum and knowledge. The other is how we can digitalize somehow this type of knowledge in a very efficient way to make it accessible as well. So this is super interesting because the proof is there, like the knowledge is needed, even from space experts. And it's not only solved by some accelerators or one university, but really it's like a joint effort in a very nice collaboration. So going to the question of collaborations, how do you see collaborations between different projects? Eurospace Hub takes part, but as well the Complutense partners and other ecosystem actors you have around in Madrid, because that's one of the goals of the project, but it's very complex to make them all collaborate together with the same mission, because like you mentioned, everyone has their own thing. So when we say, okay, no, let's put together something and collaborate between us, or we facilitate collaborations, still this concept of collaboration sometimes is difficult to get across different actors of the ecosystem. So how do you see these collaborations?
Okay, I don't know whether I have understood well your question, Ara. And that's when, in fact, one of the questions that I was a bit, never really know very well what you are asking. So let me ask you, what are you asking about? You are asking about a generic mission. Are you talking about a space mission? Are you talking about an objective? Which is, you are thinking about a joint objective for Eurospace Hub?
I am thinking about leveraging more everyone doing a space means, for instance, in Madrid, you have the Complutense, but you have the Carlos III as well. You have other universities, at Polytechnic doing a space. But as well, you have the incubators around, you have the agencies, and sometimes the Madrid agencies, innovation agencies, they have sometimes some programs on innovation, on space innovation. Not, they are not focused on this, but they have projects and programs. You have as well industry in Madrid about aerospace. So one of the challenges I see, even if it's one of the objectives, is how we bring all of this together, not only physically, like you did in one of the dinners you organized in Madrid, but as well digitally, to be able to help, for instance, Lithuania, you know, or to share more knowledge and more technology with to Lithuania, for instance. It's like to, if we put them all together in one place digitally, we can connect to other countries as well ecosystems. So, and I see this as a first point challenge of collaboration mentality. So we have to have a mindset like we want to help each other here. So with our expertise and knowledge, that's why I am putting out there, we can say in the ecosystem. So this collaboration mindset, and the other is the ecosystem mindset. It's like, we are together. What does it mean? Means like university is together in the same ecosystem, like the industry is together in the same ecosystem, like accelerators and entrepreneurs is in the same ecosystem, like agencies. Because now when someone is talking about innovation ecosystems, they include only startups. And then maybe a professor can say, but I am not a startup. Why I have to be in the innovation ecosystem?
Yeah.
No, that's the other part of the mentality. No, we have a challenge. That's why I am asking, how do you see this? Because there are two. One is collaboration, which indicates already I want to help people with my knowledge. And maybe they are helping me as well. And the other is the ecosystem means, you can say, much more diversity of actors, like not only startups.
Yeah, well, I think that the difficulty is to have a large ecosystem. And not large is not the same thing than diverse. I don't think that it is difficult to have a diverse ecosystem. For instance, you go to Leiden, or you come here to Madrid, and you have a very diverse and rich ecosystem. And there is an interaction among the actors. Okay? But if you want to do that at a European wide scale, that's a real challenge. And I think that the work that you are doing with our website and with Collaborate is amazing. Okay, I think that's the way to proceed, is to have the information and to have the people, which is your challenge that you know very well. And your challenge is to find in a quick manner the answer you're looking for. So you connect into there and you say, I am interested in a horizon call to carry out research on space plasma and genes. And, but I don't know who else is working on this in Europe. So I want to know who else is working on this in Europe. And to do that through our platform, that would be great. But also, I am looking for someone who has this expertise or has this trajectory or has this experience or has already enjoyed these funds. Okay, this is a huge, very intelligent database to make, because you have no time to go over all the text on your recordings. You have to create the database behind. And I think that this is extremely useful. And I think that this is the only way to do it. In fact, when the people works in the field, what the people does is to get into Bing, Google, or any searcher, and then in the R search for companies in Germany working on that. And then you get a listing and you have to clean it and get the knowledge, no? And the advantage of our system is that you are giving the same weight to all the companies, the small and the big ones. And the advantage is also is that you can define the weights depending on the profile of the person who is asking for that information. And so I think it's a great job. I think that probably what we will need is to have a more close connection with LinkedIn, because LinkedIn is a forum where everybody is. Even if they don't use it, they get continuously feedbacks and calls and questions and things like that. And I think that that's important because it is widely used in the community. I think that something like that would be good, just to help the people to identify and to get there, no? And then there is one part that is also very important, and that for that you need a designer. And you have many designers around, Hara. I have seen that in the Ibiza forum, no? And this is to do something that when you see it in an intuitive manner, drives you to what you are looking for. So you don't need to read many letters to find out, and this is about this, and this is about the other, no? So it's something that when you get into the system knows, it's that person. So I am going to get these things in big, and this I am going to get in small, and through an intelligent system help you. That's a huge lot of work, because many of these things can be translated into algorithms. But you will not avoid having someone behind who knows everybody. No, it's like when you have a lot of information. We manage a lot of information, a lot, okay? And everything is well organized because there are people very well organized in our team, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes you're looking for a specific item and there is one person that you go there and say, you know where it is that? And say, here it is. Yeah? And that person is a person, it's not a machine.
Yeah, that's a combination always when we are working on the adoption of the digital tool. It has to be very clear. I mean, like the tool is helping you to do your work, but it's not doing your work, that's which right. Means this is a beautiful as well part. Like as well now, everyone is talking about AI. What does it mean? Well, it means like it's helping you. All the technology, always the point has to be ethical technology, is to help you, to give you superpowers, we can say. But still, we have to use our intelligence, and our power we have in our brain to help other people, no? To help you or to help the university for the transfer or the industry to find the right expert faster. I think it's a combination of intelligence. And that's the part of the challenge with large amount of data. Mm-hmm. Or like you mentioned, the curated data. Like it's not something like, boom, you have, but then you have to clean up. You know, like in theory, the digital, this our Eurospace Hub has to give you already filter and clean and easy to visualize and to find for that. So what are the knowledge, the technology, what is doing the other person, what is looking for, what they need, if it's a match for you for that manner. And of course, then you have as a person or as an expert or academic or entrepreneur or industry, you need to do your work to make it this work, we can say, no? Like share what type of projects you are doing, which type of knowledge you have, what you are looking for, what you can offer to others, how you can help others, how the other they can help you. So this information is in your brain and it's nice, like it's still in your brain. No machine can read what you are thinking still. And this is still like you have your own superpowers matched with digital tool superpowers. I think that's I think the perspective has to be, of course, there are many other opinions out there, of course.
I think that one of the things that is very important, and that's probably our finding in this project, is the level of support that the European transfer offices need.
Yeah,
totally. They are not well supported.
Mm-mm.
They are not well understood by the main actors. Mm. I know that there are many structures and networks, and they share information and they help each other, et cetera, et cetera. But still, there is a lot of work to do in there.
Yeah.
In that.
You are listening to a Eurospace Hub special episode from the podcast Business of Collaboration.
So we are going to the basic questions, super quick, Ana Inés.
Okay.
What does it mean for you, innovation?
Well, for me, innovation means to do something new. Literally, is to do, because it's something that you made. It's not something that you think. No? When you create something new, it's creation. No? Or invention. But it is not innovation. Innovation is to do something new, from my point of view.
What does it mean, collaboration for innovation?
It's work together to do this thing, that you need many different actors to make it feasible. So, for instance, you have an idea to do in a spaceship, but to do it, actually, you will need many different actors that go from engineers, but also go for lawyers, economists, and psychologists, and physicians, everything, everybody.
So now we are going to the personal questions to know you better. As a Professor Ana Inés Gómez de Castro, what does your morning routine look like?
Okay, so I come here early, about 8:30, 9. I have a coffee. I need a coffee in the morning. No, one, two coffees, one after the other. And I use that time also to talk to the people of my team. We usually go, several of us, and also people from university community, which is very interesting. So sometimes we have interdisciplinary discussions about eagles or whatever, because our closest cafeteria is in veterinary school. But basically that. Then I come here and I start with Mels and manager of the groups I lead. Then I review what we have to do with the responsibles of my team. So for operations, for computers, for general management, for the laboratory. And basically all this takes me all the morning. And then after lunch, I try to do science. I say I try to do because sometimes I have to do management of science, yeah? But yes, I try to save it for science, so I supervise my PhD students, see how they are progressing, and also I do well research on the formation of planetary systems, which is my research line, plasma physics.
What is your favorite place for holidays?
Well, I don't know whether it's my favorite. I think that is quite my favorite, but it's the most frequent one is Vitoria, which is in a small town in the Basque Country in the north of Spain where I am from. So I have family and friends, and I love the green countryside and going around and hiking and all of that.
And food maybe as well in the Basque Country.
Yeah, too.
But, in Madrid there is good food.
Yeah, no, the thing I like the most is that everything is in walking distance and getting into the countryside and the mountains, and I love that a lot. And family, of course.
What are you doing with your spare time and your weekends?
Well, read. I read a lot. and walk by the countryside and go by the streets. I like to walk Madrid a lot. There are many interesting places to go. Just wander around. That's typically what I do in a weekend. Go to the movies occasionally or to the theater. But very urban-like in a sense, but also walking and reading. Yeah, nothing. I am not super skiing person or a super diver, no.
You are reading a lot. Would you like to recommend a book?
That's the problem. I read a lot. I cannot recommend a book. Because if you're talking, what would you recommend me? I can tell you about science fiction, which I like a lot. But I can tell you about history that I also like a lot. And read philosophy, history of thought. And so there are many things. I would not recommend any.
So, but if you cannot recommend, what is the book you are reading now?
Now?
Yes.
The book is by Santiago Posteguillo on Julius Caesar, the history of Julius Caesar. So the beginning of the Roman Empire, the end of the Republica. Very interesting, by the way.
Very interesting. And you would like to recommend a piece of music, like, you know, in Yellow Space Hub, we play a lot with music.
I don't know what to tell you because, again, I like many different kinds of music, no?
At last weekend, or I don't know, what is the last music? It was in your Spotify or even in your CD, DVD, I don't know, in your car, or if you have a vinyl record player.
The last music I heard was a symphony by Tchaikovsky, made for violin and orchestra. It's in Spanish, it's Re Mayor. I don't know how it is in English because I know that they go by letters.
And even German and Dutch letters are different, so this is a chaos.
but that I like. I think it's the only symphony written by Tchaikovsky for violin and orchestra. It's beautiful. I love it.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Gómez de Castro, for this interview. Because you explain a lot of things, really. It's a very, we can say, multidisciplinary podcast we have done. So if you can do a final word for your students, if they are listening, or former students, they say, come here and do our new, maybe, program, or what is your advice for your students, like now they are in the industry?
I would say is that space is the new frontier. And space exploration is everything. So if you want to open frontiers, get into a space and get into our activities.
Thank you, Ana Inés.
And thank you to you for making this effort, Jara. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to our Eurospace Hub special episode from the podcast, Business of Collaboration. Please share this podcast with your space friends and leave comments on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or on Stitcher. See you next month for another story and interview. In the meantime, you can learn more about us on www.eurospacehub.com.